If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema. All lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content. So if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 78. Hi and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 78. This is Terry Frost. And this time around we are doing the Alphabet Project, the D movies. Now if you hear a bit of a squeak in the background, that's Jill the kitten, who is keeping me company while I record this part. Had a bit of that problem like I had last time around, and thanks to Elaine for letting me know that there was a bit of audio stutter on the last podcast. I've been troubleshooting that for about an hour now, and I think I've got it nailed down. But I apologise for the audio stutter the last time around, and I will hope that it doesn't recur. I think the things I put in place may well have rectified that. So anyway, how is everybody? We've been okay here. Mostly doing movie-related stuff, oddly enough. I've worked it out between the two podcasts I do a month and the radio. I'm doing a dozen movies a month at least that I talk about. So there's like 4 for the podcast and 4 for the radio. That's 8, isn't it? Yeah, so 8 movies a month that I've got to research the guts out of and give to the masses, in a sense. So that's keeping me fairly busy too, because I try to do my homework on these things. This time around I've had less time to do the homework because I'm recording this a week early. I am attending Continuum 7, which is the local science fiction convention, next weekend, all weekend. So it doesn't give me a lot of time to record the podcast. So this is going out a little bit early. There's a bit less feedback this time around, but we should be fine and everything should be going sweet. So, what have I been watching? Let me just check my Mizzo. And it says, what's a 404 error? No, it doesn't. Let's see. I did see a really cool short sketch thing, which is viral in the Scandinavian countries. Apparently in some countries, I think it may be Denmark, this is shown on every channel on New Year's Eve. It's a small sketch called Dinner for One, which is quite interesting. It's just basically a thing where there's a 90-year-old lady who has a dinner with friends who are all imaginary, and her butler pretends to be all of the characters, and he does all the toasts and he drinks all the wine that goes with each course of the meal and ends up totally shit-faced while he's serving the meal to her. It's a silly little thing, not a nice physical comedy, but I thought I'd give it a chance and take a look at it, and it was a bit of fun. Freddie Frinton is the butler in the thing, and I think it's May somebody or other is the lady in that, and it's great physical comedy. May Warden and Freddie Frinton, they're the two, and the imaginary guests are Mr. Pomeroy, Mr. Winterbottom, Sir Toby, and Admiral von Schneider, and the butler James does all the different voices for all the characters. So yeah, it's an interesting little piece, but it's really odd that it went viral for Scandinavian countries. I did see X-Men First Class as well, by the way, and I found that was fun. Michael Fassbender fantastic in this film. I love it when actors do this kind of action film, summer blockbuster, Northern Hemisphere summer, of course, blockbuster, and really bring their A-game acting to it. It brings so much more to them. I mean, you have a look at how subtle, say, playing the same character, in fact, Ian McKellen is playing Magneto. He, you know, he's got his tongue slightly in his cheek, but he really does bring that kind of gravitas, and in his own way, Fassbender does as well. James McAvoy's in it, and he's fine playing Professor X. Not fantastic, but fine. January Jones playing Emma Frost, who's one of the great femme fatales of cartoons, Emma Frost. She looks pretty. Pretty face. Not sexy at all. Really kind of epic fail on that part of things. This is a character that's supposed to seduce all sorts of people, and yeah, she's got the persona of a nun in a way. I mean, you know, zero sex appeal kind of thing, which is really odd. But what can you do? You get somebody for their name, and whatever they bring to it, they bring to it. And I don't think she brought as much to it as a lot of the other characters. The special effects are great. The minor characters are interesting. They're kind of the whole 60s Avengers in the Emma Peel, John Steed sense Avengers. Kind of come James Bond vibe about it. It's kind of groovy as well. But yeah, that one should check out. Let me see. Given that it's only been a week since I last podcasted, haven't watched that much. I rewatched The Court Jester, which I did on the radio for ABC Local Radio in Darwin, and that was fun again. But it's one of those movies that I'm not going to watch very much in the next few years, so I get unused to it. I was kind of looking at the mechanics of it and things like that, and I enjoyed it less than I had in the past, maybe because I watched it a few times in the last few years. But again, it was good fun having a chat about that and putting it all together. I did see a documentary called It Came From Kuchar, which was about a couple of underground filmmakers from San Francisco, George and Mike Kuchar, who are identical twins, or identical-ish twins. They've kind of gone sartorially and tonsorially different over the years. And it's just about the underground films they make, and it's a lot of fun because they're both kind of engaging characters. They're both incredibly eccentric characters, and for what, about 40-50 years now, they've really kept that underground vibe alive. And if you're into that sort of thing, it's definitely worth checking out. So what are we watching, what are we talking about this time? Watching, let's all watch it together. What are we talking about this time? We're talking about the D movies, which in this case is DOA from 1950, starring Edmund O'Brien, and the other D movie we're doing is from 1933, The Four Marx Brothers, Duck Soup. So I'm going to take a little bit of a break now, and I will be back, and we will talk about one of the two movies.
Attention, please. A $50 reward will be paid for information leading to the arrest and conviction of anyone caught stealing our speakers. If you accidentally pull a speaker loose, don't worry. Just turn it in. There is no charge, and we'd appreciate it.
So anyway, on with the movies. I think I will do Duck Soup first, because it's the shorter of the two films. Duck Soup only runs about 68 minutes. I was surprised at how short it was, really. It's a Marx Brothers comedy from 1933. It also has Zeppo Marx. So it's got the four Marx Brothers as the titles card on it. Harpo, Chico, Groucho, and Zeppo. And I'll just play a little bit of Groucho as Rufus T. Firefly, who is the president of Fredonia, one of the two countries that are at war in this movie, the other one being Sylvania, and the head of that is played by an actor called Louis Calhoun. But this is Groucho Marx playing off one of the great comic foils of all time, Margaret Dumont, as the lady who basically bankrolls him into running the country.
We've been expecting you. As chairwoman of the reception committee, I extend the good wishes of every man, woman, and child of Fredonia.
Never mind that stuff. Take a card.
Card? What'll I do with the card?
You can keep it. I've got 51 left. Now, what were you saying?
As chairwoman of the reception committee, I welcome you with open arms.
Is that so? How late do you stay open?
I've sponsored your appointment because I feel you are the most able statesman in all Fredonia.
Well, that covers a lot of ground. Say, you cover a lot of ground yourself. You better beat it. I hear they're going to tear you down and put up an office building where you're standing. You can leave in a taxi. If you can't get a taxi, you can leave in a huff. If that's too soon, you can leave in a minute and a huff. You know you haven't stopped talking since I came here? You must have been vaccinated with a phonograph needle.
The future of Fredonia rests on you. Promise me you'll follow in the footsteps of my husband.
How do you like that? I haven't been on the job 5 minutes and already she's making advances to me. Not that I care, but where is your husband?
Why, he's dead.
I'll bet he's just using that as an excuse.
I was with him till the very end.
No wonder he passed away.
I held him in my arms and kissed him.
Oh, I see. Then it was murder. Will you marry me? Did he leave you any money? Answer the second question first.
He left me his entire fortune.
Is that so? Can't you see what I'm trying to tell you? I love you.
Oh, Your Excellency.
You're not so bad yourself.
Oh, I want to present you, Ambassador Trentino of Salvania. Having him with us today is indeed a great pleasure.
Thank you, but I can't stay very long.
Not even a greater pleasure. Now, how about lending this country $20 million, you old skinflint?
$20 million is a lot of money. I shall have to take that up with my Minister of Finance.
Well, in the meantime, could you let me have $12 until payday?
$12?
Don't be scared. You'll get it back. I'll give you my personal note for 90 days. If it isn't paid by then, you can keep the note.
Your Excellency, haven't we seen each other somewhere before?
I don't think so. I'm not sure I'm seeing you now. It must be something I ate.
Look here, sir. Are you trying to...
Don't look now. But there's one man too many in this room, and I think it's you.
That just goes to show you the machine gun pace. This movie rolls along at 68 minutes. It's chock full of stuff. I'll give you the Tracy that we've got from good old Wikipedia. Let me have a look here. Is there something that resembles a synopsis? Let's see. The wealthy Mrs. Teasdale, Margaret Dumont, insists that River Tea firefighter Groucho Marx is appointed leader to the small bankrupt country of Fredonia before she will continue to provide much-needed financial assistance. Meanwhile, neighbouring Sylvania is attempting to take over the country. Sylvanian Ambassador Trentino, played by Louis Calhoun, tries to foment a revolution, woos Mrs. Teasdale, and attempts to dig up dirt on Firefly by sending spies Ciccolini, Chico Marx, and Pinky, Harpo Marx. After failing to collect worthwhile information about Firefly, Ciccolini and Pinky infiltrate the government, where Ciccolini is appointed Secretary of War after Firefly sees him in the street selling peanuts. Meanwhile, Firefly's personal assistant Bob Rowland, Zeppo Marx, suspects Trentino's questionable motives and counsels Firefly to get rid of that man at once by saying something to make him mad and he'll strike you and will force him to leave the country. Firefly agrees to the plan, but after a series of personal insults exchanged between Firefly and Trentino, the plan backfires and Firefly slaps Trentino instead. As a result, the two countries reach the brink of war. Adding to the international friction is the fact that Firefly is also wooing Mrs. Teasdale and likewise hoping to get his hands on her late husband's fortune. So that's basically it. So doing plot lines on Marx Brothers movies is a difficult thing at best because it ain't about the plot. It is about the wordplay, it's about the jokes, it's about the side gags, it's about everything there. Now, this one was written by a particularly interesting couple of people, Bert Kalmar and Harry Ruby, who wrote songs together, of all things. There's an album of Zero Must Still singing Harry Ruby songs, which is totally one of the most ridiculous albums in the history of the universe. It's just crazy songs with crazy titles and some of the most interesting songs around. It's really an odd and unusual thing. Now, there are a couple of other people in here beside the characters I've already mentioned. Charles Middleton turns up playing one of the judges in this film. People know him better as Ming the Merciless in the old Buster Crabbe Flash Gordon movies. But back to the Marx Brothers for a bit. They started out in vaudeville, of course, as pretty much everybody did. They were part of a band called the Four Nightingales. Harpo, Gummo and Groucho were. And they were kind of boy singers travelling around. And they were doing a really bad performance in Nacogdoches, Texas, when they began cracking jokes on stage just to keep themselves amused. And it went over really well with the audience, so they kind of kept it. At one time, all of them did ethnic accents. Chico, you did the Italian one. Groucho did a German one up until 1915 when the Lusitania was sunk and people didn't like Germans after that, so he went into his smart-ass Groucho shtick at that time. And basically, they were doing incredibly well in vaudeville. They had three hit plays on Broadway, and then, of course, went into the cinema. There is thought to be a lost short film that was never released by the Marx Brothers called Humor Risk in 1921, so it was a silent film. But they really kind of kicked it into gear with The Coconuts in 1929, Animal Crackers in 1930. There was a short film called The House That Shadows Built in 1931. They're in Monkey Business in 31, Horse Feathers in 32, and then Duck Soup, which they were all the ones with the four Marx Brothers. Then on, from then on, it was the three Marx Brothers, and they went on to do The Night at the Opera, Day at the Races, Room Service, At the Circus, Go West, The Big Story, Night in Casablanca, and Love Happy. They were all in the one more movie together, the three of them, The Story of Mankind, but they didn't appear with each other. But, of course, Groucho then went on to be in other films as well. He was in the world success sport Rock Hunter in 1957, The Mikado in 1960, and Otto Preminger's weird LSD movie Skidoo in 1968. So, yeah, very famous. And, of course, Groucho was the real kind of breakout star of it, and but unfortunately he was the one that was most recognized in public. Harpo and Chico were never recognized in public without their makeup and without their wigs on, so they could just wander around, people wouldn't notice them particularly, but they were really able to be themselves when they were off screen, pretty much, apart from Groucho, who, of course, also did, I forgot about that. He also did You Bet Your Life, so he did a quiz show on television for a lot of years as well, cracking one-liners and, in general, keeping his profile up. And a lot of people that really were part of that resurgence in interest in the Marx Brothers in the 1960s, a lot of the teenagers at the time who were really hip to the Marx Brothers had seen Groucho on You Bet Your Life when they were kids and kind of took it on from there. So when I was re-watching the film, which I hadn't seen in a few years, a few things I noticed. There's a couple of bits that now could be perceived as racist. There's a reference to, and I'll put this in air quotes, darkies in one joke, which kind of falls on its face in the 21st century. And there's a kind of bit where they sing a song about war, which goes into a bit of mocking of spiritual type singing and things like that. They do a thing about All God's Children Got War, which is a reference to, I think, Eugene O'Neill's play in 1921, All God's Children Got Wings, where Paul Robeson in the play played a black man who was trying to become a lawyer, and his white wife kind of undermines him so he doesn't get a career as a lawyer. So you can look that up. But that brought up an interesting thing for me. Even though we get a lot of the jokes which kind of pepper Duck Soup, like shotgun blasts in a wall, there are also references that you've really got to dig out with a bit of a historical shovel to understand, and that being one of them, All God's Children Got War sort of thing. Really, there's probably, if I went through it piece by piece and go, okay, what do they mean by that, and then did a thorough search on the web, I could find out what each individual part of things really meant. But one of the interesting things about this film too, apart from the frenetic pace and the fairly short running time, is the fact that when it does come to war, and yes, Fredonia and Sylvania do go to war, and there's all sorts of bits and pieces about the stupidity of war there, and mocking the idiocy that is politics and diplomacy and war. I mean, that's the whole theme of the thing, is that most countries are run by idiots, and they go to war for stupid reasons. Now, that history, of course, has changed that viewpoint a little bit, and I'm pretty sure Duck Soup wasn't all that popular during World War II, if it was ever shown at all. It really was out of step with what they needed to have in society at that time. When the war occurs, Groucho's got so many costume changes, he does a comic opera, presidential uniform, he does everything, including a Davy Crockett cap, as his different uniforms, and every time they cut back to the scene with him at war, he's wearing a different uniform and ordering different things. And basically, it's all an anarchic farce, really. And I think one of the interesting things is this sits halfway between cinema and stage work in a lot of ways. It's still only 1933. Sound cinema's less than 5 years old at this stage. And so the kind of ludicrous idiocy of it is very much a stage-based thing. This is around the time stage shows like Hills of Popham were starting to appear, which were influenced by the Marx Brothers themselves. It would have been fantastic if some footage of the Marx Brothers on vaudeville on stage had been done and had survived, because it would be interesting to see how different the Marx Brothers on stage were from the Marx Brothers in the movies that we've seen them in. Now, of course, the Marx Brothers legend lived on after the Marx Brothers. There was a play done called Minnie's Boys about the Marx Brothers. And in 1999, there was a stage play done called Groucho Marx, A Life in Review. So basically, you know, there's still content being created in some odd and kind of worshipful ways about the Marx Brothers. Now, from a personal viewpoint, I love the anarchy of it. I really do like the kind of craziness of it and the fast patter. I mean, they had the best writers around. Of course, they had Harry Ruby and Bert Kalmar in this one, but S.J. Perelman, one of the great satirists of the first half of the 20th century, worked on Marx Brothers films as well. And, yeah, just that kind of fast-paced silliness and that kind of incredible love of words and sentence structures. They love it so much that they make fun of it and play with it. For the Marx Brothers, the physical universe and words were the toys that they played with, and they were essentially childish characters, lecherous teenage boys being played by kind of aging Jewish guys, and really a lot of fun because of that. Now, Groucho then went on later on to, of course, have his other careers. And even, I think I've seen some of the footage of Groucho in The Mikado, where he plays Coco in The Mikado. And does a very good job of it. He's still Groucho, but he's still in character in a really unusual way. And that was in the 60s too, so he'd racked up a few birthdays by that stage, but he was still pumping it out there. There are a couple of really good comedy bits in this film too, but for odd reasons, Groucho's not in any of them. Oh, sorry, I apologise, I misspoke. He's in the mirror scene. Now, the mirror scene, which had been done before, but is done incredibly well in this film, is Pinky, dressed up like Firefly, pretends to be Firefly's reflection in a missing mirror, matching his every move, including absurd ones that begin out of sight to near perfection. Now, the physical comedy of this, them mirroring each other, is incredible. I mean, this is a shtick which had been done before and was done afterwards. I mean, I don't think there's a cartoon that hasn't done it at some stage, that kind of mirroring of things. And they swap positions, and Firefly has a white straw hat behind his back, which he's about to bring out because he's not quite sure whether this is reflection or not. And Pinky has a top hat, a black top hat. But when Firefly puts the straw hat on his head, Pinky pulls a straw hat out of nowhere and puts it on his head with the top hat still behind him. So it's a lovely bit of work there, and the coordination is fantastic. I mean, Chaplin had done it in 1916 in The Floor Walker, and Max Linder, the German silent movie comedy, did it in 7 Years Bad Luck. But it's a lovely little piece of work. And now there are some other really interesting bits as well. There's a bit with a lemonade seller while the guys are selling peanuts at one stall and the lemonade sellers at another stall, and that guy that works with Harpo and Chico is an actor called Edgar Kennedy, who had a very long career. He was known as the king of the slow burn. He'd get an exasperated facial expression and he'd rub his hands over his bald head and across his face and trying to keep his temper, and basically he was an old school comedian who'd done short subjects in the silent era and things like that. And he plays off the Marx Brothers incredibly well. He's a kind of everyman in a sense, that he's just trying there with his lemonade stand trying to make a living, and these two anarchic fools come along and basically fuck him over big time, which is lovely, and he really does kind of play off them well, as indeed does Margaret Dumont and Louis Calhoun and things like that. The lovely thing about the Marx Brothers is, seems to be, from what I can see, their generosity towards their straight men. They mock them, they mock the physical, their physical appearance, they mock them, who they are, they mock the personalities and things like that. But they, without that person to play off, they'd just be being nasty. So the reactions of Margaret Dumont keeping her dignity, even though he's, Groucho is alternately insulting her and trying to seduce her for her money, is quite an interesting phenomenon. And of course, again, when they play off Louis Calhoun playing Trentino and him trying to keep his dignity while he's actually a greedy pig underneath, and then you've got the working class Edgar Kennedy playing off against Chico and Harpo. So it doesn't matter which social strata you're on, if you kind of get sucked up into the Marx Brothers whirlwind, you're going to come off second best. And that's the part of the fun of it as well. These guys are forces of nature in a weird way. They're implacable. You could put them up against Arnold Schwarzenegger's Terminator, and for some way, by some magic of either Harpo having a blowtorch in his pants pocket or something, they would overcome a Terminator, these guys. They're just implacable. And that of course, is the joy of it. In a world where people had, and at the time, 1930s, it was the start of the Depression, people had wanted to keep their dignity, and there were so many social constraints, having this kind of anarchic humour in place was a kind of safety net and a kind of pressure valve, so that people could mock the mighty and really acknowledge, even at some level, the absurdity of politics and power and diplomacy and the manners that are impressed upon the individual by society and all that sort of stuff you could talk about with this. But basically, yeah, that they were doing good work by showing up the silliness of things. Now, of course, bad time to kind of start taking the piss out of war and taking the piss out of things like that, because it's the same year when Hitler got in Germany, and of course nobody knew what that would end up like ultimately, but really it was just a little bit off being out of step with this time. And that's unfortunate too, because I think that that kind of disrespectful movie is something that would be nice to see now too. Anyway, I'm going to leave it at that. Apart from saying, he said, just looking over at the bookshelf here, and I find many inspirations to this podcast looking over at my bookshelf, I've got a copy of Groucho Marx's book, Memoirs of a Mangy Lover, which is a terrific title for a book, and it's all about love life and social notes from the social outcast is one of the chapter headings. It happened to eight other guys, Marx's philosophy according to Groucho, and all this sort of stuff. There are a whole bunch of little essays by Groucho Marx with some cute illustrations on them as well. And if you can find a copy of that, Leo Hirschfeld actually did the illustrations. If you can find a copy of that, it's just a fun book to browse through and just kind of go into the silliness that was Groucho Marx. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when we get back, we're going to be talking about a kind of B-movie film noir, which has got a kick-ass premise to it, being DOA from 1950, starring Edmund O'Brien and directed by Rudolf Matej. But before I do that, there's a couple of things I want to do. One of which is James Arness, who people remember from Gunsmoke, and was also the monster in Howard Hawks' version of Thing from Another World. Sorry. Thing for Another Word. Thing for Another World died yesterday, in fact, at the age of about 88. Not a nuanced actor, but very popular, and sorry to see him go. One of the other things I found out, which is a bit sucky, well, not quite as sucky as someone dying, but nonetheless has certain qualities of suckiness about it, is the fact that Tim Rice, who did a lot of musicals with Andrew Lloyd Webber, is doing a musical adaptation of From Here to Eternity in 2012. Now, I'm sure that it's going to be fucking ordinary, but yeah, can't really see it happening. It's just one of those things where you read it in online and go, oh, fuck, why are they bothering? Really, doesn't need a stage adaptation unless they're going to put in the original language that was used by James. Is it James Jones who wrote it? Let's see. I'll find out who it was because I have Wikipedia at hand. Got to stop second guessing myself. Yes, it was James Jones. But yeah, James Jones' novel and, of course, the movie don't really need to have a remake. There was a TV movie remake of it done in the 1970s, but I don't really think that we need a musical. I'm not too sure what Pruitt and Judson are going to sing about when they have their big knife fight. Now, you see, there's the thing. Are they going to adapt the novel or are they going to adapt the movie? Because if they're going to adapt the novel, it's Pruitt and Fatso Judson who have the knife fight. If they're going to adapt the movie, of course, it's Maggio and Judson who have the knife fight. So that will be the defining moment of that particular endeavor. Anyway, I'm going to play a bit of music and then get back on with the next movie now.
I'm heading upstream and chasing after my dream. You want to come, you say. But in my canoe, it's much harder to, and I get out that way. You say, let's marry and promise to care. Girl, can't you take it until I make it? Life is a real bumpy road. Nothing's succeed like success, and I guess I wanna be just like all of the rest, like all the rich men who have been blessed. Nothing succeeds like success. I'll sympathize with all the tears in your eyes. Success, and unless I make it, it won't pay. And when I get up to the top of the ladder, maybe I'll look down. I'll reach out my hand to you, I'll try to pull you through. I hope you'll still be around. Cause nothing succeeds like success.
There's a bit of blue-eyed soul for you. That was Bill Deal and the Rondells with Nothing Succeeds Like Success. So, on to DOA. Now, you've got to like a movie that has been remade twice over a 30-odd year period, and the original is still better than the other two. DOA, which was written by Russell Rouse and Clarence Green, was remade in Australia, of all places, remember that place, in the mid-1960s, 1960s, as a movie called Colour Me Dead, starring Tom Tryon, Carolyn Jones, Rick Jason, and a bunch of Australian actors like Tony War, Sandy Harbutt, who directed Stoners in that one as well, Michael Lawrence, Peter Sumner, people who Australian listeners might know. So I'm actually finding a copy of that, so I'm going to watch that and I'll let you know next time how it went. But I don't think it's anywhere near as good as the original. It was also remade in 1988 as, again, DOA, starring Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan. Again, not anywhere near as good as the originals. It was actually remade by a couple of people whose main claim to fame was that they did the Max Headroom TV series. I've seen the remake of DOA, and like a lot of things in the 80s, you think, what the fuck? Why did they bother? Why did they try this? They were looking for a vehicle for a celebrity couple, one of whom self-admittedly was hoovering up the cocaine like Tony Montana at the time. So, yeah, what can you do? Anyway, original DOA, Edmund O'Brien, not a kind of star actor. He was kind of a bit stocky, let's say, and not a classically beautiful-looking actor. But he is fantastic in this role. He won an Oscar, the Best Supporting Actor Oscar, a few years after this for a movie which I really like called The Barefoot Contessa, where he played a sweating publicist called Oscar something or other. Let me just see what I've got there. I'll try to find the character's name. And again, he was in a movie that we've talked about before, 99 and 4400% Dead. That was his last film role. Unfortunately, he was afflicted with Alzheimer's and didn't do anything subsequent to that. He was, of course, in the original movie of 1984, not the television adaptation, but the original movie in 1956. He played Winston Smith. He was also in 7 Days of May. If you don't know the actor, you'll know his face. And the good news about this film, too, is for some reason it fell into the public domain. And if you go to archive.org, you can find a reasonable copy of it, which is what I did for this purpose. I've probably got a copy somewhere in the shelves, but wasn't able to locate it, and it is a solid movie. I'll just play the audio from it, which sets up the premise really nicely. This is right at the start of the film. Frank Bigelow, the character played by Edmund O'Brien, walks into the San Francisco Police Department and into the Homicide Bureau, and here's what happens.
Can I help you?
I'd like to see the man in charge.
He's in here.
I want to report a murder.
Sit down.
Where was this murder committed?
San Francisco, last night.
Who was murdered?
I was.
Which has got to be one of the best starts to a film noir ever. It's just, totally off the wall and totally cool. I'll try to find you a bit of a premise about this film because I really do like it. I was trying to find D movies to do for this, and when I thought of D.O., I thought, yeah, I'll give it a go, but then I rewatched it, and I'm really, really incredibly fond of it. So here we go. Here's a plot. So I'll leave aside the bit that it then breaks into a flashback after Bigelow says, I was, in his hometown of Banning, California, where he is an accountant and notary public. He decides to take a one-week vacation in San Francisco, but this doesn't sit well with Paula, his girlfriend, played by an actress called Pamela Britton. His confidential secretary and girlfriend, since he's not taking her along. Bigelow accompanies a group of from a sales convention to a night on the town. He ends up in a jazz club where, unnoticed by him, a stranger swaps his drink for another. The nightclub scene includes one of the earliest depictions of the beat culture. The next morning, Bigelow feels ill. He visits a doctor where tests reveal he has unknowingly swallowed a luminous toxin, i.e. a radioactive substance, for which there is no antidote. A second opinion confirms a grim diagnosis, and the other doctor implies that the poisoning must have been deliberate. With a few days to live at most, Bigelow sets out to untangle the events behind his impending death from radiation sickness, interrupted occasionally by phone calls from Paula. She provides the first clue. Eugene Phillips tried to contact him, but died the previous day. So I'll leave it there. And basically, Bigelow follows the track through and finds out why he was killed ultimately. So I thought, I thought when I first saw this movie many years ago that it was kick-ass. I mean, it's not a large budget film. It was made by a fairly small company called Cardinal Pictures, which was very short-lived. And they were the ones who unfortunately failed to renew the copyright in 1977. But the director, Rudolph Matei, was an interesting character as well. Like a lot of other people, and a lot of people talk about it in Paleo Cinema, he was a refugee from Europe who was part of the cinema community over there and then became a part of it, of course, in Hollywood. He worked on Passion of Joan of Arc, the Carl Theodore Dreyer film in 1928, and Vampire in 1932. He worked mostly as a cinematographer in Hollywood in the mid-30s. He did Dodsworth, which is a fantastic film, another good D movie as well, come to think of it, with Walter Huston in it. He did a Laurel and Hardy feature, Our Relations, in 1936, and he was a cinematographer on Stella Dallas. And he won the nominated for the Oscar for Best Cinematography 5 consecutive years for Foreign Correspondent 40, That Hamilton Woman in 41, The Pride of the Yankees 42, Sahara in 43, and Cover Girl in 1944. He turned to directing in 1947, and he made one of the directorial credits for him is When Worlds Collide, which is a fantastic little science fiction movie George Powell did in 1951. So, yeah, fairly good. You know, not one of the top-line directors, but a fine cinematographer. He was an uncredited cinematographer as well, I just found out, on The Lady from Shanghai. So you've got to give the guy kudos for that. And he cinematographer on Gilda, Cover Girl, Down to Earth, It Had to Be You. So, yeah, he's definitely got the chops there. And this film, even though it's a low budget, was made for a small company, is quite interesting. The music by Dmitri Tiomkin is one of his earlier soundtracks, and it's very kind of full-on orchestral, hard, percussive kind of thing. And it starts right at the beginning when Bigelow is walking into the homicide things. This film's great because it does a couple of things which are really, really useful for a low-budget film noir. And it's fortunate that it was made outside the normal studio system. Cardinal Pictures, of course, being not a part of the big studio system. It was distributed by United Artists, but it didn't have studio written all over it. And that reason, basically, why it works so well is locations. There are a lot of locations on this film. Some of them in Los Angeles, faking for San Francisco. The Bradbury Building in particular, which you'll know from any number of movies and TV shows, features in part of the climax, and a few other buildings as well as that. But there were some stolen shots of Edmund O'Brien running down Market Street in San Francisco, which basically they didn't have permission to do it. And he's running through a large crowd of people and bumps into people who don't even know they're in a movie at the time. So it's that kind of guerrilla filmmaking a bit. And it's just a relentless little film noir where this guy's got to find out who killed him before he dies and really kind of goes to town with that. And it's got some fine actors in a fairly low budget. I think Pamela Britton's interesting as Paula, his girlfriend, because she seems to have a skill when he's off on this kind of bachelor holiday, even though they've got a relationship, of kind of reminding him that she's there. She'll call him up and kind of prod him and remind him of why she's there kind of thing. So, yeah, interesting little thing. She had a career up until the 1970s as well. She's mostly well known for DOA, but she had done a couple other things. She was Frank Sinatra's girlfriend in Anchors Away, and was on Brigadoon in Broadway as well, so she actually had a stage career. And I think she's a fine actress, and I think she plays this one very well. There's a kind of modulation to what she does and the way she plays the character, which is interesting. She knows that he's going off to sow some wild oats, but she's kind of reminding him to come back to her, which, of course, ultimately doesn't happen because of the film itself. But one of the bad guys in the film is played by Luther Adler, who was the brother of the acting teacher Stella Adler, and at one stage was married to the actress Sylvia Sidney for a while. And he's quite good as one of the nasty little pieces of work villains, a guy called Majak, who has a couple of good scenes in this film and kind of brings a nice line of menace to things. Beverly Garland, who people might remember from a lot of 1950s science fiction films, is in this as a Miss Foster, one of the secretaries to one of the corporate type characters in the film, and has a pretty good role. And the other outstanding person in this film, of course, is Neville Brand, who plays Chester, a psychopathic henchman to Majak. And he had an interesting life as well. He was the second most decorated U.S. soldier in World War II, just after Audie Murphy. And so he definitely had kind of hero cachet in there, but ended up playing a lot of heavies. The thing I remember him mostly for when I saw him on television in the 1960s was he was in Laredo with William Smith and Peter Brown and Philip Carey. So he played a character on that who wasn't a villain, but Brand, of course, played a lot of villains and things. And in this one, he's pretty good. There's a few scenes where Bigelow, who's not feeling the best because, of course, he's dying of radiation poisoning, gets punched in the gut by Chester with a pistol. And I think that kind of broad acting suited Neville Brand a lot more than a lot of the other roles that he did over time. But, you know, he's an interesting actor. He had more teeth than a piano and really brought what he had as a generally tough individual to the playing of Chester. There's a great shootout scene in a pharmacy, which is done not on location but in studio, and it's great. The action pacing and the plotting of the action in that particular scene is incredibly well done and really, really fine. And I'm just going to play another bit of audio from it now where the diagnosis of death is given to the Frank Bigelow character, of course, played by Edmund O'Brien. And I kind of like the writing in this bit too. It's menacing while being oddly compassionate. And I don't think doctors could get away with talking to a patient this way these days.
According to the information you gave Miss Wilson, you're not married, Mr. Bigelow.
That's right.
Do you have any relatives, family, anyone in San Francisco?
No, no one. I don't know a soul in San Francisco.
Where is your home?
What is this, doctor? Why all the questions?
You're a very sick man, Mr. Bigelow.
Sick? But you told me I was in good shape.
Yes, I know. But my preliminary examination didn't reveal your true condition.
You sound as if it's pretty serious, doctor.
It's extremely serious.
I want you to understand that we wouldn't tell you something like this unless we were absolutely certain.
Well, of course, of course.
You must steel yourself for a shock, Mr. Bigelow.
Well, go on, doctor. What is it you're trying to tell me?
Our tests reveal the presence in your body of a luminous toxic matter.
What is that exactly?
A poison that attacks the vital organs.
Poison?
We have no alternative but to tell you this.
Your system has already absorbed sufficient toxin to prove fatal.
I wish there was something that we could do.
What do you mean, wish? You mean there's nothing?
There is nothing anyone can do.
This is one of the few poisons of its type for which there is no antidote.
Well, this is fantastic. This is the most ridiculous thing.
We don't have very long.
What do you mean?
A day. Possibly a week. 2 weeks at the outside. It's hard to say exactly.
Well, this is impossible. I don't believe it. You've made a mistake. That's it. It could be a mistake, couldn't it? You have made a mistake, haven't you? Answer me.
Dr. Schaefer is an authority on toxicology.
Been no mistake, Mr. Bigelow.
Do you realize what you're saying? Well, you're telling me that I'm dead.
Okay, so wrapping up, why do I like this film? A, it's got a fantastic premise. A man going after his own murderer. That's a lovely little conceit for a film, and it's followed through really, really well during the film, where Bigelow, who, you know, being a man, like, it's 1950, chances are he did something in World War II, so he had a little bit of a background in violence, and you see that a little bit where you see him dodging some gunfire at a factory. So basically, but he becomes fearless because he's got nothing at all to lose. He doesn't have a single thing to lose. So when people are acting tough with him, he really, he's gone beyond fear. And there's a bit where he's being beaten up by Chester, where Luther Adler's character tells Chester that Bigelow's not scared. And that's a very telling thing, because Edmund O'Brien plays it really well. You can see that he's hurting from being punched in the gut when he's got a gut full of poison. But you can see the fact that the character's not scared. And Edmund O'Brien did have the chops as a good character actor. He really did bring it to those kind of roles. And in this one, even though he was a star, he brought the kind of three-dimensionality of a character actor to the role. The scenes, particularly with Pamela Britton's character, are really good, where he's talking with her while he's just been flirting with one of his clients in his office and things like that. And you know this is a conflicted kind of guy. He's got a steady girlfriend who is helping him with his business. He knows that that's ultimately where he's going to be, but he's a bit restless, which is why he goes to San Francisco and doesn't tell her until the last moment. He wants to sow some wild oats before he kind of gets his ducks lined up. But unfortunately, because he goes and sows his wild oats, he doesn't get an opportunity to have that kind of life with his girlfriend that both of them ultimately, and there is a kind of slightly melodramatic but heartfelt scene on the phone where he tells her he loves her, and that really he's kind of doesn't want to tell her what's happening because he doesn't want her to be hurt by it. Now, what's up with Sal? And Sal's take on it was he was a stupid fucking guy that wouldn't let her help him. And I can see that. I can understand that from my own life experience that you got in trouble, even if it's something you want to protect the people you love from what it is. But on the other hand, ultimately, you need them. You need your support. So it's a particularly male thing that we want to protect those we love from bad news, but they're the ones who can actually see us through bad news. And I found that really interesting. And I just ended up saying to Sal, it's a guy thing, don't worry about it. But anyway, very fine film. I do like this one a hell of a lot. It's not the kind of film I'd watch a lot, but it's one of those ones I'd recommend to friends. And the fact that you can download it for absolutely zip from archive.org gives it an advantage to it. It has been put into that registry of valuable films by the Library of Congress. So it is considered a classic of its genre, and of course being remade twice, they don't do that with just any old movie. But anyway, I'm going to take another break now. I've got a little bit of feedback, but given that I'm recording this a week early, not as much as usual, so the next lot is going to be gangbusters, I hope. So I'm going to take another break and then get back with what feedback I have, and we'll wrap this puppy up. It's going to be a little shorter than podcasts have been recently, but next time around, hopefully I'll have a lot more to say and a lot more feedback. Was Edwin Starr with Hell Up in Harlem from the Fred Williamson movie of the same name, directed by Larry Cohen, which was the sequel to Black Caesar. Let's see. Let's check out what feedback we have. Okay, I got a voicemail. That's the one where they talk, isn't it? Okay, a voicemail from Morris Brzezinski. Hello, Terry. Well, after the fun that was Horrorpalooza, I went out and bought the Drive-In Delirium DVD that Mark Hartley put together with hundreds of similar trailers, all categorizing into horror, nature, blaxploitation, etc. Might have been a bit excessive to buy them, but I might just dig out a disc and watch 10 trailers here and there where the mood to watch Needless Gore arises. I love hearing your critique of Coffee and was able to watch the trailer on one of these DVDs. In a world away from those films, I'm glad to hear you program Duck Soup for your next show. I saw it years ago and loved it, but will watch it again with my daughter before I listen to your assessment. She was introduced to them via A Day at the Races a month ago, and she loved it. Cheers, Morris. And I've got to put another plug in for his blog, lovethatalbum.blogspot.com. Thanks for that. Yeah, I missed out on Horrorpalooza. It was screening of a whole bunch of trailers done by Mark Hartley, who did Not Quite Hollywood and Machete Maidens Unleashed down at the Astral Theatre in Melbourne. I kind of had something else on that weekend, which was unfortunate. But, yeah, apparently it went over really well. I'm going to have to make sure that I'm there if they do ever do that again as part of the St Kilda Film Festival. Also got an email from David Grant saying, great cast as usual. Haven't seen either of these in years. I still remember crying the first time I read Flowers for Algernon. This is about Charlie. When Charlie starts to regress, it's just crushing. Yeah, it is. And this is a little bit of a spoiler, but given the arc of things, what can you do about it? I did also get an email from Rob Kelly saying, dear Terry, just wanted to drop you a line to say how much I like the podcast. I discovered it a few weeks ago when I did a search on George Pal and found your Pal-centric episode, which I enjoyed. So I subscribed and have been catching up with the show ever since. Whoops, hang on, that's the wrong one. Here we go. Terry, love the chat with Sal. In the latest episode, I know you said she doesn't want to be on much, but I hope she comes back soon, if only to defend Wizard of Oz some more. Read Coffee. Love the movie, though. I remember the first time I saw it being quite disturbed that Alan Arbus was in it playing a sleazy mafia boss. Mr. Arbus played a warm-hearted psychiatrist, Dr. Sidney Friedman, in MASH, and in a lot of ways he was my favourite character on the show. Seeing him as such a scumbag was quite a jolt. Keep up the good work. Rob Kelly. Yeah, thanks for that, Rob. Yeah, it is. Alan Arbus, really interesting guy. Must have had a fantastic life, if only because of his wife and her photography. But I also got a bit of a Facebook message from Marty Cook, who says, hey, Terry, enjoyed hearing you and Sal on the latest podcast. You should do that more often. Sally did a good job, and it's always fun to hear partners who don't generally agree on movies. I have had the same early cinema experience as Sally, E.T. being my first in cinema, Return of the Jedi being my first in drive-in. Yeah, well, that's the thing with being born in the 70s. That kind of stuff's going to happen, man. You should have picked a better decade. I happen to have picked the 50s, which it worked well at the front end of things, but is working less well these days. But, I never actually... I'm kind of very glad that I didn't drink the Kool-Aid on E.T. because watching it, I found it hideously manipulative. And I've said this about E.T. a number of times, that I don't mind a movie seducing me, but I really hate it when it jams a cold hand down the front of my pants and tries to jerk me off. And I think that E.T. and a lot of Spielberg's output is that kind of film, which is why I'm not as enthused with Super 8 as a lot of other people. I'll probably see it, but I don't really have that kind of 80s kid nostalgia that a lot of other people do, which, again, is a generational thing. But I really, not for me. So that's all of the feedback I got, and we're running up to about 58.46 minutes of podcast so far, so I'm going to try to take this up to 60, and I'll flesh it out a little bit by playing a track at the end of the podcast. Thanks for your attention. Thanks for all of the great feedback I'm getting. I really do enjoy doing this, and I'm going to be talking about podcasts and other stuff and movies and other stuff at Continuum 7 here in Melbourne next weekend. If you can pop in, say hi, please do. Always happy to do that. I'm a lot friendlier than I used to be. And
it's really nice to be able to kind of share the love face-to-face as well as doing the podcast stuff. So that's on next weekend, a long weekend here in Melbourne. So it's going to be 3.5 days for me of convention. Sal's doing Sal stuff, so she's not coming along with me, but it's going to be a bit of fun. And anyway, I've got to wrap this up now because I've got to edit it and upload it ready for next weekend. And I've got a birthday party to go to. So anyway, look after yourselves. Enjoy your movies. Friend me up on Facebook if you haven't already. Happy to do it. And you can kind of keep pace with what I'm doing as far as the podcast and which movies I'm watching through that. Again, the the podcast blog is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. Always happy to have comments there as well. So take care of yourselves. Watch good movies, watch bad movies, but don't watch mediocre movies. I'll see you soon. Bye.
You're dreaming of me. The clock's striking midnight, the moon's riding high, a bat flutters by, everybody's getting goose pimples, cold icy fingers that run up your spine. Whoa, 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 come closer, come closer, those fingers that you're feeling are mine. So carry on screaming, carry on screaming, 'cause when you're screaming know that you're dreaming of me. Each single heart beats a sickening thud, curdles the blood. Oh baby, ain't it romantic? I've locked the door and I've swallowed the key. Whoa, 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 come closer, come closer, 'cause you bring out the monster in me. So carry on screaming, carry on screaming, 'cause when you're screaming, I know that you're dreaming of me.